Boker Tov, Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome to our 21st consecutive Sunday, I believe, in this wonderful series from King Cyrus to Lord Balfour. And today's Achron Achron Chaviv. So I want to thank Rabbi Liebtag and, a special thank you for learning with us these last, 21 Sundays. And thank all of you for coming and participating. And okay, Yesher Koach, we'll make a hadra, make a siyum afterwards. And Rabbi Liebtag, please, God isn't going anywhere. We'll continue with the Kabbal Shirim on Pesach at the same time, but next week also. But for this series, by Cheney, Lord Cyprus, and that will move to the 19th and 20th century, I believe, and Lord Balfour. Bakasha, thank you very much, Rabbi Liebtag. Bakasha.
I sent a link to the source sheet. I'll send it again to my Google chat if you want. And a word of introduction before we begin. Because it's the last share, most of today's share will be a bit of a summary of the key points we made. I'm trying to apply them just a little bit to today. The main thing we'll talk about today is why, what we can apply, what we shouldn't apply. And I'll leave a little more time for questions today because I'm assuming you have questions that we've been holding off for a while. So I want to begin by explaining the title and how we're going to go from title to topic. So let's get my source sheet up. Here we go. Share screen and source sheet. Here we go. Our title today, which was this retitled, we came up with the title yesterday, sort of. Okay. With the second Isaiah, considered Lord Balfour the second Cyrus. That was just to be cute. That's not the topic. That's the title. Remember? The title is what the people want to hear and the topic is what the teacher wants to teach. So let me explain why I use that title. Our whole goal of the series was not just to learn Torah, but also to help appreciate modern day controversies. Now, the reason why I'm saying appreciate, I want you to appreciate why I'm saying the goal is to appreciate. What I don't want to do is say, oh, here's what happened in the past, and that means this is what we need to do today. I want to take, oh, I can prove from Sefer Nehemiah, from Sefer Ezra, or from Zachariah, cares that everyone's hyped today to make Aliyah, or we should vote for this party, or we have to take over the whole West Bank, we should give everything back. Okay, let me do a... Do you want to get the mute? Okay, let's get the mute real quick. What I don't want to do is I don't want to take what we're learning and reach a very concrete opinion. Even though you'll hear many opinions like that, you'll hear a whole spectrum of opinions of what needs to be done today. We talked about this before about the idea of the beginning of our redemption, Reshis Michat Goloteinu. And the main thing I tried to explain all through the series was the purpose of prophecy is not to predict history, but to shape history. And if we're going to learn something from previous stories and previous events in history and previous prophecies, it's primarily what can be, not what will be. It's not that I can read this and the same thing's going to happen today, or this is going to happen on this year, or I can do a calculation of gematrias and things like that. I'll figure out when Mashiach's coming. The main purpose is I want to show you that in the beginning of the Second Temple period, there was a lot of potential. The prophets saw great potential for the Second Temple period. How much it was fulfilled, that was in our hands. Rabbi Yehuda Levi, if we have a chance, we'll see him, talks about that very explicitly, that Nevuah is something. I think it was one of our earlier classes we did that, where the Navi says what can be, it's a potential. What we put into it is what we get out of it. On the side, I'm talking about this idea whether a prophet can have his own opinion. We'll have to see certain verses in when we get to Yeshayahu, whether it's everything Yeshayahu is saying word for word from God, or is God giving some direction to Yeshayahu, and Yeshayahu can take God's direction and apply it to his own time period. So we'll have to talk about that as well. Now, as a way of introduction, I'm assuming some of you or many of you are also listening to Rabbeinu's series on Tehillim. So I'm not going to, that's why I didn't bring these sources explicitly, but I want to begin with this question. Can you see the hand of God in historical events? What happens when we don't have a Navi? If we have a Navi, so a Navi can tell us that the declaration of Cyrus, that was the hand of God. That was the opening line of the book of Ezra, which we're going to return to that very soon. So if you have a Navi, a bona fide Navi that everyone accepts and he's given guidance from God, and he tells you this event is the hand of God, then of course you can listen to him or you can trust him. What happens when there's no more Nevuah? Is it possible to see the hand of God in historical events? Is it permissible to see the hand of God? And how do we interpret it? What do we do? And I think that's the biggest question that we're faced with in our time period. So I want to bring one line from, I want to take a quick look at Tehillim 107 real fast and show you something, which I'm assuming Rabbeinu talked about. I'm not sure if everyone is in Rabbeinu's class, but I'm assuming some of you are. What I want to show you is, wait, here we go. Tehillim 107, here we go. It's pretty much the bottom line of Tehillim 107, but if there's one chapter in Tehillim that talks about Shivat Zion, talks about returning, it's definitely Tehillim 107. It's almost prophetic. It wasn't written to be a prophecy, but it almost turned out to be a prophecy. So the opening lines, which we're all familiar with Hodu Lashem Kitov, we have to give thanks to God or recognize God. His chesed, his kindness is forever. Usually chesed in Tehillim many times. It's not just referring to kindness, but kindness in the framework of a covenant. And who must thank God and acknowledge God? Gulei Hashem, those who are redeemed by God, who he saved them from any trouble, not only from personal trouble, but also from what's called Kibbutz Galiot, who brought us back from the different lands, what we call Kibbutz Galiot, or returning from exile, from the east and the west, the north and the south. That's the introduction, which is followed by four famous examples. And based on these four examples, we have what's called, what we call nowadays, Bench and Gomel. In biblical times, you would bring a Thanksgiving offering called a Korban Todah. Now, the four cases are not the only cases, but they're examples of cases where someone would need to bring a Korban Todah. The first case is someone lost in the desert. The second one, someone in jail. The third one, someone deathly ill. And the fourth one, someone lost at sea. In each of the cases, what happens? They're in a life-threatening situation. In that life-threatening situation, they call out to God. It's always the same verse. They cry out to God in their trouble to ask them for help. And when God brings help afterwards, they thank God for his assistance. Again, these are all cases of personal trouble. And the second case, someone in jail, incarcerated, same thing, crying out to God and thanking God when he's helped. The third case, someone deathly ill, crying out to God. And the final one, people going into down at sea and basically lost at sea in a big storm, thinking all is lost. And again, they cry out to God and God comes and saves them. And after God saves them, they have to thank God. Yodu Lashem Chasdo is repeated four times. And the halacha is built on verse 22 that brings Divrei Todah. That's the first half. And many people have pointed out, which is almost prophetic about this, that even though this is talking about individuals in personal distress, it turns out that in our recent history, in the last hundred years of Zionistic history, those who returned to Israel in our own Kibbutz Galut of the 20th century, we've had all examples of that. People coming from concentration camps, people walking through the desert, people lost, people coming deathly ill, people coming by sea. Remember, every single case here, if I look, people went through deserts, in Africa, through the Sahara on the way to Israel. People came through sea. Many have never made it. People came from incarceration, not just in Cyprus, but from Germany. People deathly ill. And all of them came back to Israel. Not everyone made it, but many who returned went through those troubles. And when they come back to Israel, they have to come and thank God. That's why the custom in Israel is to read this chapter in Tehillim on Yom HaTzimut right before Marv. Now, at the end of the chapter, there's sort of an add-on, almost like an epilogue to the chapter, where it talks about how God can take mighty rivers and turn them into a desert, and vice versa. He can take a fruitful country and turn it into something dry. Sounds like the Negev being totally dry and coming back to life, or planting fields and setting up settlements. Again, all this is famous. I just want to go to the last line. What's the bottom line of the Mizmor? What's the bottom line of the Psalm? Verse 42 of Membet, Yiru Yisharim Vismachu. Those who are straight or go the right path, they should be happy when they see this. And they should be upset by any injustice. And then what's the final line? Mi Chacham Vishmor Eile. Who is wise and keeps these things and watches these things? Vidbonunu Chasdei Hashem. Litbonen, I'm not sure how to translate the best way. How would you say litbonen in Hebrew? To discern, I guess. To discern litbonen is more than just to see. but it means to look behind the events and discern behind these historical events the kindness of God. Again, not just kindness, but kindness in the framework of a covenant, where God has a covenant commitment to his people to bring them back ultimately to their land. And it's almost a call to see the hand of God in history. Now, there's two stages here. One is to see the hand of God in history, and when something good happens and you're saved, to thank God for it. The big question is, once you see the gain in history, can you build a vector out of it and see a direction? Is God sending you somewhere? If you see a set of historical events, can I thank him for those historical events? Or in addition to that, can I connect the lines together and see this event, this event, and God is telling you to do something? And that's a big question. We know in the time we began with, in the time of Ezra, or actually in the book of Ezra, but in the time of King Cyrus, when we have an historical event where the Jews have the opportunity to return to the land after the Persian government defeats the Persian king, defeats the Babylonians, is God telling us, is that a sign from God it's time to return? So the Navi says it was. We'll see that in Yeshayahu. But how about nowadays when there's a similar event? Was that, if I want to compare the Cyrus Declaration, the Balfour Declaration, can one, we could thank God for that opportunity, but was God telling the Jewish people it's time to return? Now, of course, there were many Jewish leaders, religious leaders, who said yes, others who said no. And I used that example from the time of after World War I, after the Balfour Declaration. I explained why that argument made sense. It was logical why some rabbis would see the hand of God behind it and some wouldn't. Everyone, you know, 2020 hindsight is easy. It's pretty clear in 2020 hindsight, God wanted us to come back. Was it so obvious that everyone should have reached that conclusion? We brought that argument to appreciate why so many people in the time of King Cyrus, even when there was a Navi, they didn't return because they had lots of reasons thinking it's not redemption. So I'm not being critical of those who didn't return, but I think there's no doubt that there's a pattern in Jewish history we've seen. God's brought us back to our land. And therefore, there's no doubt to fulfill Tehillim 107, we have to acknowledge God, thank God, for sure say hallel or some type of praise of God on the anniversary, on Yom HaTzmaut, or even all year long, to have that in our thoughts and our prayers. Does it tell us what the next step should be? Does it tell us, therefore, if God gave us half the country, we have to capture the other half of the country? Or does it say, you know, we have to take this direction, or it's forbidden to stay overseas and you have to make aliyah? I think that's taking a bit too far. On the other hand, there's definitely room for an individual to see the hand of God and make a personal decision. So if someone's inspired by these words and by these events and wants to make a personal decision to make Aliyah, I think that's fine. To say everyone has to, and everyone has to interpret the events that you do, without a Navi, I think that's more difficult. So if I want to summarize that point, I see there's a need to see the hand of God behind historical events, even without a Navi. In regard to thanking God when something good happens to the Jewish people, you as an individual or to us as a people, to interpret that event and infer from it what the next step needs to be and what does that mean, what other people need to do, a Navi for sure can do that. A modern day person can reach his own conclusion and make his own decision. I don't think he has the right to tell other people what to do. He can discuss it with them, he can encourage them, but I don't think it's in the realm of, I know, I understand the ways of God, and you don't. I think that's a little dangerous, especially without a Navi. On the other hand, there's somewhere in between where you can appreciate what's happened, and an individual can make his own decision of what to do with that. I think there's many people who have done that, but that doesn't mean that, you know, it's obvious what needs to be done. Let me take a quick break and look at the chat because I said I'd look at questions today and there were lots of chats. Let me stop the share and here's the chat. Okay. As Nevuah, problem in translation of Nevuah is prophecy telling the future. Okay. Again, I pointed out many times that a Navi doesn't mean he predicts the future. A Navi is God's spokesperson and the job of God's spokesperson actually has a double purpose. One is to pray to God on behalf of his people. Navim do that a lot. On the other hand, God through his Navi gives a message to his people. Not only here's what you must do, but here's a direction you can go in, or here's an opportunity. Okay. Maybe at the end about concept of Dat Torah, you have to believe something to discuss it. You have to believe that it exists. That if we talk about Dat Torah later on, we'll see. I Okay, discerned. Okay, Nipponen to discern. That's a good word. Okay, now we get to work.
Rabbi, I was in the middle of typing, but since you stopped, I'm just going to point out, if I may, that's why people like Rabbi Lam, Malava Shalom, and others much prefer the term Avinu Shebashvayim Tzuri Sebeva Golo Barecha Medinat Yisrael Shetehe Rishit Smitat Kulateinu. And I mean that on a serious level, that it's a little bit of, you know, I don't know if you want to comment on that. It's not that, you know, if we're not sure.
My version of that, as long as we brought up the topic, I say maybe half in jest, Shahita. Not Shahita because it was already. In other words, Rashid is the beginning of something. I think we're way past the beginning. Now, I'm not saying Shahita that it's over and we missed it. Don't miss that. I don't want to be misunderstood. When I say Shahita, that doesn't mean it was and it's over. I'm saying that the beginning of the process, I think, happened already. I would say that it should continue.
But based on what you said, that you can't be sure your interpretation is correct, wouldn't it be more appropriate to pray that it should be? Okay, so keep out Reishit. It's, you know, gulatenu.
No, like, no. There's something you're saying. You're saying that it should be the Reshit, the beginning of our redemption process.
No, you have to pray not that it is. You can't factually say that this is the beginning of our redemption. We don't know.
There's a big assumption, which I disagree with. You're making assumption there's one final redemption and that's it. There's this
I'm not making any assumptions. I'm just saying, based on what you're saying, we don't know. We don't know, which I happen to agree. You know,
I'm saying something totally different, I think. I'm saying that in my eyes, at least the way I see it, that a redemption process began already. What'll be with it? There's nothing wrong if the redemption process lasts 100 years, 500 years, 200 years, like the Second Temple period. The fact that the Second Temple period didn't work doesn't mean it wasn't meaningful. The fact that it ended, there's value to partial redemption. We do that in Dayenu, don't we? We thank God for every stage of redemption. And the fact that a redemption process doesn't reach its ultimate goal and final goal doesn't mean that there's value in the different stages. And the main thing we're praying for is not for the end result. The prayer is supposed to be transformative in order for us to make it better. In other words, we're not praying that our opinion is right. The prayer, I think it's very basic to prayer. Prayer is not thanking God for always for what happened. It's reminding yourself. It's not asking God to work for you. It's reminding yourself that you work for God. So you're not praying to God, bring gula so I can have a nice life and I can play king of the hill in Israel. I'm praying to God to remember that if God gives me an opportunity of redemption, what I need to do with that redemption? What's my responsibility? I'm not thanking God, oh, you gave me this privilege. I'm remembering I have a responsibility. And if God brought me back to the land and gave me a country, recognizing the hand of God behind those events is something that should cause a person to be more committed, not to checking if that prediction is going to come true, but you can make that prediction happen by taking action. Now, what action to take, you can argue in Hashkafa. Does it mean conquering more land, setting up more settlements, or being kind and just, or, you know, helping the poor and needy, being a light to other nations? You could argue, based on your Hashkafa, how you can make that process, how you can be a not just a spectator, but a player in the game. You can be part of the process. And then you can argue what's the best thing to do based on your understanding and based on your abilities. But praying that just sitting back and praying, the hoping it's going to work out, that my team wins kind of thing. That's why I think both sides misunderstand the whole point. That's my understanding of the prayer when you pray that it should be. I think we're past that stage. It is already. There's a process of redemption. We have to hope that it continues. So we're praying God to bless the state and give us and help us help ourselves. But the main purpose of prayer is for us to do things. The same thing, not just in this prayer, in almost any type of prayer. Most of the prayers are remembering your relationship with God and your responsibilities. Not that God's working for you, but that you're working for God. Anyway, that's a topic on prayer. We'll get back. Okay. Before I get myself in trouble, I better get back to the class. Someone said redemption began the day after destruction of the temple. That's, you know, that's a famous midrash with Rabbi Akiva, I think, you know, watching the foxes in Har Bayit. You know, destruction happened, you know, the growth of Zechariah happening, it's beginning. But on the other hand, it started, but it's starting very slow. You know, it didn't, we're looking for the spike. It might have begun, but we went through a lot of trouble from the time the temple was destroyed till today. The idea that redemption began from the day it was destroyed, I'll bring up one point I think Marty Lachshon talked about a lot in his series, is that the biggest problem Judaism faced, especially in light of Christianity, is that after the Second Temple was destroyed, the biggest problem is you can reach a conclusion, very logical one, that God left his people. Not that God doesn't exist. You can continue to believe in God, but you can say, no, God gave it two tries, First Temple, Second Temple, that we did such a bad job that God dumped us. We'll see this in Yeshayahu in a minute, which is, I think, the very beginning of Christian theology in the after the destruction of the Second Temple, when early Christianity begins. And they're proving to the Jewish people, the fact that you haven't returned to your land, the temple is not returned, and you're still in exile after a couple hundred years, that's a sign that God left you. And believing that, not knowing that when it'll happen, but knowing it can happen, and it will happen one day again. We don't know when it'll happen. Just the understanding that we're still God's people, and one day we'll come back to our land and be his nation again. That understanding is core to being Jewish. And therefore, when the rabbis say redemption started the day after it was destroyed, they're coming to say that exile is not an irreversible process. Or basically, that's Yechezkel's dry bones, where the people are saying, we're like dry bones. And the Navi is saying, no, these dry bones can come back to life. But a very logical conclusion for people to reach that once the temple's destroyed and we're all in exile and there's no return after 100, 200 years, it's very logical to assume that it's over. And that's why all the Nevuot, especially nowadays, when we see we've returned to our land, I think it's a major, it's something we have to recognize, the hand of God in history. And it's I guess it gets called a booster to realize that we're still God's people and we still have a responsibility. That doesn't mean that we won. It means that we have more responsibility now, that God's chesed, you know, God's kindness within the covenant still exists. Okay, now let's get back to our source sheet and our main topic. Okay, I brought Tehillim 107. Tehillim 105 we'll skip for now. I think we talked about it before. Okay, now, way back, we talked about two models of tshuva. I'm just bringing this up now because we had it yesterday's Haftarah from Yechezkel Lamed Vav. If you remember Yechezkel talking about we went into exile. So Yechezkel said, because of your bad deeds, you went into exile. And I'm going to bring you back. And Yechezkel talks about return, even though you're not worthy. God will bring you back because of the Chilul Hashem, because of the desecration of God's name. The very fact Jews are living outside their land and they're in a foreign land, no matter how they're acting, the very fact that God's people are not in their land and they appear to be abandoned by their God, Yechezkel says God will bring you back even if you're not deserving. But once you come back, you have to go through a process of purification, and therefore you return before, even though you're not worthy. But once you come back, even though God brought you back, even though you weren't worthy, then comes the stage you become worthy. After you return, you have to go through purification. Yirmiyahu, in chapter 29, we saw, this should be good way back towards the beginning, Yirmiyahu gave a different model of redemption, where first, God will give the opportunity after 70 years, but we have to want to return. But God says your return is contingent upon you wanting to return. And we use that to explain the reason why many people probably didn't answer the call, King Cyrus, because they saw we weren't ready yet. We weren't prepared yet to be God's people. In our own time, if we do return and we see we're not religious, we're not deserving possibly, then that's a good sign from Yechezkel that now that we're back, that means we require a purification process. What we have to purify, ask your local rabbi, was what elements of Judaism we have to focus on and do better on and improve on to be worthy of that redemption continue. Now, the last thing I'm going to talk about before we get to Yeshayahu is what happens after the return. That goes back to what I was discussing with Rabbi Kelman before. Is there just one final redemption and then everything's great and perfect and no one has to work again and everything's great? Or when we pray for Gula, are we praying for an opportunity? What we called before, Gula is the third cup, not the fourth cup. Meaning in the four Lashonot of Gula and the four phrases that we talk about at the Seder from Parshat Vayera. I'll take you out of Egypt, I'll save you, and I'll redeem you. But the fourth cup, not the third cup, but the fourth cup wasn't Gula. Gula enables the fourth cup. The fourth cup was Har Sinai. I'll be your nation. You'll be my God. You'll be our God. We'll be your nation. And therefore, in order to become God's people, we need to be back in our land and be a nation. We have to have a political entity in our land and be sovereign in our land in order to be a nation serving God. As individuals, we can serve God anywhere, as a community, as people, as individuals being God's people. But to be a nation, a sovereign nation in the land, and serving God as a people, Gula is required to reach that stage. What you do at that stage, so Gula enables the next stage of becoming God's people. So when we pray for Gula, Gula is not the last stage of the process. It's a critical stage. It enables the next stage of becoming God's people. And therefore, what does Yishayahu say in the famous Isaiah chapter 2? That there'll be a time. Achrit Yamim might mean the next generation or in a future generation. That all the nations will be coming to many nations. When we're back in our land and acting properly, many nations will come and they'll want to come to God's house and come visit Yerushalayim because direction, instruction will come from Yerushalayim, Ki Mitzion Tzei Dvar Torah Dvar Shem Yerushalayim, and we'll be in a position where we can provide arbitration for other people. V'shafat bin goyim, v'chiach lamim rabim. What's interesting, if you follow the context, Ki Mitzion Tzei Torah doesn't mean we're going to teach Talmud and Torah and Moshe classes to the other nations, but rather we'll give instruction and other nations will respect us and appreciate how we're running our country. They want to see how we deal with the corona, you know, issues, and maybe they can learn from us, just a modern day maybe example, or maybe they can confess how not to act or how to act, but they can learn from us, and hopefully they can learn from us, or through us we can bring world peace in the sense that people use their industry not to make an arms war, but rather to help people grow food and take care of health and things like that, and they'll turn the swords into plowshares. The famous line, this is the line that's on the United Nations, Isaiah outside the United Nations. So therefore, in order to enable this long-term vision of Yishayahu, of Achrit HaYamim, so you need to return to our land and be a people. But here the goal is much more than just living in our land. Here it's how it's having a nation, a sovereign nation, enables us to return. What we do with that nation, Isaiah is hoping that that nation becomes a light to other nations. Okay, now, we saw the same theme in our share last week in Zechariah. He said, remember the people were asking, do we have to continue fasting or not? And Zechariah told them, don't ask me, you're missing the whole point. God's giving an opportunity to return. And if you do mishpat and staka, and keep ebet for shalom as we saw, if you do justice and righteousness and love peace, and live properly and act as God's model nation, then the fast days can become holidays. And then he brought the same message that other nations will come to Jerusalem. That was the end of last week's share. We saw that. And the final line was, and Ish Yehudi would be in Yerushalayim, in the Beit HaMikdash, bringing the name of God and the concept of God to non-Jews, waiting in line for inspiration. And Shlomo with his tefillah said something very similar when he built the temple, that even a non-Jew should come because they hear your name and how great you are and your relationship with us. And then Shlomo prays that God should listen to the prayers of the non-Jew, that they should fear him like we fear him. But if we're not doing a good job, then they can't learn from us. So he says, "Laman yidun kol me'etzet shemecha, all nations should know your name and fear you like Israel to know that your name is associated with this house." That can only happen if we're acting in a way that sanctifies God and of a messianic process. Now, some people could say, if we're not acting in a way that sanctifies God, what's the point of having a state? On the other hand, once you have a state that enables you to reach this point, so having a state is one stage, the next stage can be education and acting in a way and that you'll build a nation that will sanctify God in their behavior. Now, in light of that, we have to get to our title of Isaiah. Now, we talked about this earlier in the year. I just want to review the key points. The title Second Isaiah is not what they call kfir. I'm not going against anything rabbinic. The book of Isaiah is 66 chapters long, but there's many opinions, not just in academia. Also, there's a wide range of opinions in rabbinic thought as well, that from chapter 40 to the end might not be the Isaiah from the time of Chizkiel. Remember, the Isaiah in Perek Aleph, he's giving his prophecies in the time of Uziel, Achaz, Yotam, Achaz, Chizkiel, kings of Yehuda, which is like the 8th century BCE, the 700, Chizkiel is time of Sennacherib, that's around 700 BCE. Because from chapter 40 on, he's talking about the return of Israel from exile, and he mentions by name the Persian king Koresh. And therefore, the assumption is he's writing maybe 200 years later. The question is going to be, why did a later Navi, who wrote most likely those Nevuot, maybe it might be one, it might be more than one, why would Chazal or the Anshei Knesset HaGdola who were canonizing the Bible and the books of the prophets, why would they take a prophecy of a later Navi and add it as an epilogue or an appendix to an existing Navi? You have something very similar in the book of Shoftim. We have the stories of the Shoftim through chapter 16. And then from chapter 17 to 21, we add another unit to the book. Something similar might be happening in Zechariah as well. But a book could be over, and then we can have an add-on. In the book of Yirmiyahu as well, we have is Nevuot, and then we have an add-on, also an add-on by Yirmiyahu, though, but Nevuot about other nations. But the idea that a book could be over, and when the book is over, we add something else, that's legitimate. The main point from a religious point of view, that it's a Navi writing, and it's the word of God. As long as it's Navi, we don't need to know the Navi's name. If Chazal canonized the book, it's a word of Nevuah. What did we gain by claiming that chapter 40 to the end, at least most of the, it could be some of the materials from earlier, but a big part of the material, the prophetic material from chapter 40 to the end, is from the time of the beginning of the Second Temple period, because based on its content, if the Navi's job is not to predict events, but rather to shape events, his main call is to look for the hand of God in historical events, in Koresh's declaration. And for Isaiah, 200 years before those events, to talk about the return from Babylonian exile to Israel, before the Babylonians even came into power, when the Assyrians are giving us a hard time, and talking about it's sort of taking all the freedom of choice, all b'cherach of sheet away from the Jewish people, from the time of Chizkel through Menasheh, Yoshiel, Yoakim, Tzidkel, everything, and just skipping 200 years of history and saying that that was all predetermined, which is very hard, I think, to accept. I think it makes a lot more sense that the rabbis took a later Navi and added it to our book of Isaiah. Why they hid it has to do with the time period of Megillat Esther and the idea of hiding things. I call it hiding our dirty laundry, or hiding something that's a bit embarrassing. I think it's hidden in the back, because when you read Isaiah from chapter 40, you see that God gave us this opportunity and we didn't take it. We didn't answer the call. I mean, I think when you hide something, you want to keep it because it's important to have it. On the other hand, you don't want to be embarrassed by it. So I think my understanding is why Chazal put from chapter 40 in Isaiah to the end and left it pretty much anonymous and attached it to Yishayahu, I think for two reasons. One is, it's an important message for all generations. It was primarily a message for the generation of the beginning of the Second Temple period, which wasn't answered in its entirety, and it ended up becoming quite a failure at the end of the day. But the idea behind it remains forever. So to give it its eternal meaning, we want to leave it anonymous. And also not to embarrass that generation and to sort of allude to something bad happening without saying it explicitly, that might be another reason for keeping it anonymous. Now, why am I saying it's a prophetic call of return in the beginning of Isaiah from chapter 40? Because in the book of Ezra, which is reviewing the events, now this is, Ezra wasn't born yet in the beginning of the book of Ezra, but it's recorded in the book of Ezra. The narrator of the book of Ezra, who we're not sure who it is, but it's the men of the great assembly, they're telling us that in the first year of Koresh, our return to Israel, and Koresh's decision to allow the Jews to return, that wasn't Koresh, that was God. Of course, Koresh made that decision, but it wasn't that God came to Koresh in a prophetic dream. Koresh made that decision for his own political reasons, but the Navi is saying that was the hand of God behind those events. And this point, which I'm making here, is explicit in Yishayahu. That's what I want to show you now. Therefore, if someone views later on the Balfour Declaration and the events that unfolded after World War I that allowed the Jews to return to Israel and make a Jewish homeland, if someone sees the hand of God behind those events, that doesn't mean that God spoke to Lord Balfour in a prophecy. But it could be that someone can view the fact that after all those events after World War I, where international relations totally changed, and now all of a sudden there's an opportunity for Jews to establish a homeland in the land of Israel and later become a state, to recognize the hand of God and thank him for that, I think that's important. Was everyone supposed to interpret that as a call to return? That you can argue. And some people did see it as a call to return. Many people didn't. But in hindsight, to thank God for that, I think that is quite simple based on the parallel. Now I want to show you why it makes sense that from chapter 40 is a real-time call during the time of King Cyrus for the Jews to return, and not a prediction 200 years earlier of something that's going to happen in the future, predicting history, but rather it's a call to people, because God was telling people, be comforted. Don't give up hope. Talk to the people, the heart of Yerushalayim, and call out to it, because God's saying they've paid enough for their sins. We're not going to translate everything. I'm just going to review. You can look them up and translate them later on. But the main call, because we did this in detail earlier, God was saying, you know what? Ki lacham yad Hashem kiflayim b'chol chatateh, I punished you too much. We compared it to a parent who punishes a child, and the kid runs away from home, and all of a sudden the parent wants the children back. And he says, you know what? You know, you might have done something bad, but I punished you too hard. Now it's time to come back. Then there's a call out from the desert, open the way for God. And basically, bottom line was, you know, don't be afraid of returning. Imri la'rei Yehuda hinei Elohim. Go tell the cities of Yehuda that are now desolate. Tell them your God's coming back, your people are coming back. It's a call to the land to prepare itself for the return of God's people. Now, that continues where the Navi says the people have given up hope. That was Lama Tomar Yaakov at the very Yisrael. These are all Haftarah we do during the 7 weeks after Tisha B'Av. Okay. Why are the people saying, these thread are Kimi Hashem Yohan Mishpati Yavor? How come the people are saying God doesn't see what we're doing? God doesn't see our ways. Okay. Don't you know who this great God is? He has strength. And the main line we want to point out for our brachot in the morning, God gives strength to the weak. But the people are too weak to return and aren't ready and don't have the stamina. God says, don't worry, God will give you the strength if you put your effort in. And now the big line, which is everything we're talking about, is built on chapter 41. Vata Yisrael, Abdi, Israel, Am Yisrael, referring to them, you're still working for me. You're still my servant. You're the children of Yaakov who I chose. Your chosenness is not over. Okay. Zer Avraham Avi, we're going back to all the themes of Sefer Bereshit. And I held on to you and called out to you from all corners. And I'm telling you, Avdiata, you're still my servant. Becharticha velo masticha. I chose you, I didn't abandon you. Mi'us is when you're cut off from a breed. Remember when God unchooses Shaul, he tells Shmuel, don't look at him, ki ma'astiv. I've had it, I've unchosen Shaul. The same thing with some of Yishai's sons. Don't look at him, him I don't want. Someone not wanted by God is mi'us. Someone wanted by God is nivchar. So God's saying, Becharticha velo masticha, I've chosen you, I didn't abandon you. And that's the Nabi's main message. Don't translate exile and destruction of the temple is game over, but rather it's time to return. You were in rehab, but not over. Don't worry, I'm with you. Okay, I'm going to help you. I'll support you with my right hand. And then God says, God's calling upon you. Don't worry, because I'm redeeming you. I'm calling you by name. And he goes on, and then finally he says, I'm going to erase all your old sins. I'm willing to have a new start. I'll bring you from the east and bring you from the west. Kibbutz Galut, same thing we saw in Zecharia, calling out to all directions. And then he says, I chose you in order to, I'm saving you so you can thank me for it, so you can say hello when I redeem you. And then here comes the big part in chapter 44. It says, remember all these things, my nation, that remember that you're still my servant. I created you to serve me. Yitzatich Evedi. You, my people, don't abandon me. God is worried that the people have given up hope. And God's telling him, don't give up hope. You're still chosen. Don't abandon me. I'm willing to erase all your sins, all your bad deeds from the past. I'm willing to start a whole new slate. That's why we call these Pesukim on Yom Kippur. Shuv Elai, Ki Galtecha, return to me because I'm redeeming you. It's a call in real time. And what's the proof? He continues. He says, I'm the God behind everything. I'm going to Mekim Devar Avdo in chapter 44 in Pasuk Chavav in verse 26. I'm going to keep the word of my servant and fulfill what the prophet said, what Yirmiyahu said about returning them back. Homer Yerushalayim Tushuv, I said that I'll bring Jerusalem back, will be resettled, and the cities of Yehuda will be rebuilt, and the desolate cities will be reestablished. And there is the call, Homer the Koresh Ro'i. I'm the one who called Koresh my shepherd, okay? And we call Hefzi Yashlim, he's going to fulfill all my desires. Then Isaiah here is saying, or this prophecy in chapter 44, is saying in the name of God, Koresh, I sent Koresh. We'll see in a minute. He says he doesn't realize it's me, but I'm the one calling Koresh to be my shepherd, to bring my sheep back. I'm the one saying Yerushalayim is going to be rebuilt and the Eichal can be reestablished. The Navi calls Koresh, God's appointed one. It means he's appointed by God. God was behind his rise to power and his decision to bring us back. I've held your right hand. I gave you the ability to bring down your conquest of other nations. That's for me. And because of me, I opened up the doors of Babylon. We're open up to you. That's right in the Cyrus Declaration. And they won't be closed upon you. Okay. Then he says, Anila fenechalech, I'm leading the way in front of you. Okay. In order that everyone knows that I'm calling out in your name. And I'm doing it, why? Laman avdi Yaakov, for the sake of my servant Yaakov, Israel that I've chosen. And here's the big line. Dekra lecha bishmecha, I called you by name, means I'm telling my people, I'm calling you by name, that I sent you to bring them back. Achantcha, I got you ready. I prepared you. V'loi datani, but you don't know who I am. So here the Navi says explicitly, I'm behind all these events, but you have no idea who I am. Koresh himself doesn't realize that he's an agent in God's hands, but God's telling his people through this prophecy to recognize Koresh's actions and Koresh's decision. It's God's call to bring you back. So that's why I brought all these things in, that here we have in the time of Isaiah, I'm sorry, one last line in chapter 48, here it's explicit. He calls the people, get out of Bavel, to be Bavel, run away from the land of the Chaldeans, of Kasdim, do it with happiness, let everyone know it. Let everyone know, Imru Gal Hashem Avdo Yaakov, scream out and tell everyone, God is redeeming his servant Yaakov. And the people are saying, that God abandoned me. And God says, how could a mother, just like a mother wouldn't abandon her child, I won't abandon you. And even if a mother does, I still won't. And there's no way God will abandon his people. And that's Yishayahu's message all the way through. So here we see, I want to summarize my key point here. What do we see happening over and over again? There are historical events that are happening in real time. We have a foreign leader who, for his own political reasons, is conquering the whole Middle East, taking over, making political decisions that work out for Israel's good. The leader himself doesn't recognize the God of Israel, doesn't say he's doing it in the name of God of Israel. He's doing it for his own political reasons. The Navi is telling the people, look behind these events and see the hand of God. And therefore, translate those events. It's a call by God to return. Now, we discussed this. The people living in exile should have taken this call. It's clear that everyone took the call. We talked about that in our study, Megillat Esther, and the fact that most people didn't come, and that might have been the reason why things were so bad in the beginning of the Second Temple period. But what can we learn from that today? What I think we can learn from that is that it's possible to see the hand of God behind events, even though those political leaders aren't doing it in the name of God. And they have no idea God's behind the events, but to see the hand of God behind those events, and at least thank God for them, that for sure, you can reach that conclusion. Does it mean that God's telling you that you have to return now? I think it's a legitimate interpretation, but not a necessary one. Not one that you could prove that I can say this for sure is what God wants you to do. Now, what I want to end the share with, because we have to finish up the book of Nehemiah, is I want to show you, I want to go from this great idea of redemption to what happens at a practical level. Let me stop the share for a minute and go to the chat real fast. Okay, we'll get that afterwards. Okay. We'll talk about all those questions. We'll talk about at the end of the class. Here's what I wanted to do now. What I want to point out now is that I'll bring an example that Chazal talk about. In Yechezkel, we read yesterday Yechezkel chapter 36, and chapter 37 is the famous dry bones. Now, the rabbis have an argument. What happened to the dry bones that came back to life? What happened to them? So there's two opinions in the Gemara, if you remember them. One opinion was they got up from the graves, they said Hala, they said Shira, and they went back to the graves. The other opinion was that they made Aliyah, got married, had children, and had trouble raising their children, and had to put up with raising families, everything that comes with it. And basically went back to living to normalcy. Meaning, you can have a process of redemption, but then reality sits in. And what do you do the day after Mashiach comes, the day after redemption? And I want to bring examples from Nehemiah of dealing with problems and how he deals with them, which are so similar to today. I think it's just fascinating how similar they are. And I wouldn't say I would take the same approach as Nehemiah did, but I want you to appreciate from what Nehemiah had to deal with, what we can deal with. So we're going to open now the book of Nehemiah, and we want to do basically Siyum on Nehemiah. We have 10 minutes for this. Okay. So last week we talked about Nehemiah making that amanah, that big agreement, and they took upon themselves to keep the mitzvot, and they treated the land of Israel as though it was sovereign, even though we weren't sovereign. And that was the famous Kedusha of Ezra in the Second Temple period, that we treat the land and take Trumot and Masorot and Bikurim and everything, even though we might not have a biblical obligation, we establish a rabbinic obligation. Now, what's interesting, in chapter 12, we make a list of all the people who made Aliyah. Then we talk about, we go back in Pasuk Chaf Zayin to something that Ezra and Nehemiah did. Seems it was organized by Nehemiah, but Ezra's involved. When they finished the wall, they made a big ado about it. And to sanctify the wall, they brought two korbanot. We talked about the beginning of a korban todah, and that's why we want to end with this idea. We saw in Tehillim 107 that you bring a korban todah in thankfulness for a redemption process. When Nehemiah finished building the walls of the city, he set aside two Thanksgiving offerings. So two animals, probably, I'm assuming they were parim. I'm assuming they were cows or oxen. But in the dedication of the wall of Yerushalayim, all the Zvim were asked to come from their places. Basically, everyone gathered to Yerushalayim to make this Chanukah, with Simcha and Todot and Shir. Again, what Nehemiah is able to do, take a political achievement, you know, finishing the wall of the city and turning into a religious event, but being very practical, having singing and songs and food and a ceremony. And he brings these Korban Todah. So he brings all the singers, V'yasfuk B'nayam Shorarim. He brings the Levites and the choir. There's music there. Nowadays, we bring some famous singers there from famous band to play songs and get everyone to gather together. The Kohanim do Tahara. And what they do Bamidah Shtei Todot, we take two. Shtei Todot Gdolot. We take two Korbanot Todah, like Thanksgiving offerings. One goes to the right around the wall, one goes to the left, and then they meet in the Beit HaMikdash afterwards. We go around the wall and end up inside the temple. And Nehemiah leads one of them, and Ezra leads the second one. The first one was with Ezra. Here. The first one, Ezra Sofer, leads the way. And the second one, Nehemiah leads the way. He's with the second one. Okay, he follows it. He goes on and on. And I simply want to point out that they have this big, beautiful celebration, and they do something that brings the nation together. And the idea of making, you know, in a time of redemption, when you accomplish things, gathering at the Kotel, gathering and making a celebration with song and inviting people, I think those are good customs to keep going. And there wasn't anything like that since the time of King David with Tilah and Hodot and singing to God. Now, in chapter 13, watch what happens. Nehemiah is going to do what he did previously. You have a national celebration. You have people gathering together. It's time to open up and give a rabbi speech and learn some Torah. So, B'yamahu nikra b'sefer Moshe, bosnei ha'am. When they gather with the Korban Todah, they also open up and read again from the Torah. And they just happen to come onto what verse? The verse that we can't marry Ammonites and Moabites. Now remember, there was Tuvi Ammoni, and we had all these connections with these foreign people, and there were signs of intermarriage, which we thought Ezra got rid of. We saw he didn't get rid of. Nehemiah tried to get rid of it, but we see it's still happening. He gives the reason. And then he talks about El Yashiv the Kohen, which is Yeshua the Kohen's grandson. There was the Yeshua, remember, Kohen Gadol from the time of, we saw in Haggai and Zechariah. There was Yeshua, Kohen Gadol, and Zerubbabel. Those were the leaders. These are the grandchildren. Yeshiva is the grandson. what happened? He was friends with Tovia Damoni. He was from an Ammonite, and they had connections. Even their kids, I think, were married to each other. And he also had an office. It was Eliashiv, the high priest, gave him an office in the Beit HaMikdash. And in the same place where they used to keep all the Trumot and Masrot and all the things they need for the temple, they moved that away. And this rabbi, this chief rabbi or chief kohen Eliashiv, was using it to help a friend of his who was actually one of our sort of enemies. Okay. Now, in the meantime, this was happening when Nehemiah had gone back to Babel, back to Persia, to go back to his old job. He had to go back. And now, in year 32, he's coming back again. He went back to Artaxerxes and comes back a year later. Okay. Now, Pasuk Zayin. Listen to Nehemiah's leadership. Bavod Yerushalayim, Vavina Barash Yaseh Liyashiv L'Tovia. I saw this terrible thing that Eliashiv did. Lasot lo lishka, he made him an office in a chamber in God's house. There's corruption already. You know, he has political ties with this guy, Tovia, who's our enemy. He got angry. And what did he do? He goes in there and throws everything out of the room. Nehemiah comes back, shows who's boss, and takes basically everything that was in this guy, Tovia, office and sends it out because it doesn't belong in the Mikdash. And they cleaned it up. Now, what did he find out? He found out that they had agreed earlier, we didn't read this, but they agreed, instead of the Levites having to go from person to person to collect their 10%, their taxes, their what's called Maser Rishon, remember there's a 10% tax, an education tax, in order for the Levim to be able to work in the temple, to teach Torah, to be judges, to be singers, to guard the gates. There's several servants that without Shevet Levi, without paying and providing funds for the tribe of Levi, the temple won't get moving and Torah won't be taught. But instead of them having to go and beg everybody, each Levi on his own, Nehemiah organized a pool that everyone bring the money to the Beit HaMikdash, and trustworthy people would give out the money from the Mikdash for everyone equal. They said organized Maser in a much more organized way. In the meantime, everything became corrupt. And basically what happened, things got out of hand. And what used to be in the temple treasury now was all taken away. So what he had to do, he had to go back and basically appoint what's called, he appointed these people. So he saw corruption in the finances of giving out the Masrot for the Levim. And what does he do? He has to appoint a faithful people to be in charge of it. So what do we see? What's called accountability. And we see once you're dealing with temple and rabbinics and public funding and funding, there's always a chance of corruption within that funding. So again, a real problem. You're building the temple. You're building up the city. People are making donations and doing it, you know, doing well. But within that, there's certain people within the kohuna, within the priesthood, who are taking advantage of that, who are corrupt. And Nehemiah has to deal with that corruption and has to find faithful people to be in charge of the distribution. Of course, he wants God to remember what he did and give him credit for it. Yeah. Now, what's the next problem? There's a problem nowadays about Shabbat in the public sphere. What happens when you're returning? Can you force people to keep Shabbat? So what did he see when he came back as well? People are not keeping Shabbos. They're going to work. They're working in the fields in Shabbat. Okay. Okay. I had to warn them. Okay. Basically, he sees desecration of Shabbat, people working on Shabbat. And now we Jews working on Shabbat, non-Jews, you know, people opening up their shopping malls and trying to sell things to the Jews. They're coming every Shabbat. They bring their wares. They bring their everything they're selling, not just the fish they bring from fishing, but also all the things they're making. And they're selling them on Shabbat in Yerushalayim. Basically, the malls are opened on Shabbat in Yerushalayim. Some of them run by non-Jews, and he has to put an end to it. And what does he do? He says, when your forefathers desecrated the Sabbath day, what happened? That's what caused all this trouble. Okay? And now you're going to get God angry again with us? So what I want to point out here is you have a redemption process. People come back. We built the wall, everything set up. But they don't keep the Torah properly. And they don't keep Shabbat. And at least in the public sphere, Nehemiah wants to make sure that as a nation, as a people, now that we have a city, we're going to make sure there won't be any business to be closed on Shabbat. What's the way to do that today? I'm not sure, but the very fact that you have your nation and you have to make rules that keep Shabbat in the public sphere as a day of rest for everybody, that's important not only for religious reasons, it's also important for social reasons, because everyone deserves a day of rest. And therefore, once stores are open, you're going to sort of encourage people and maybe enforce people not to be able to keep Shabbat because they have to keep their stores open for competition. Therefore, Vaikasher Tzadlu Shari Yerushalayim Lifnei Shabbat, when it got dark before Shabbos, it's already Shkia, what did he command? He closed the gates of the city. Closed the gates of the city. He says, don't open them up until after Shabbos is over. And he told his men, it was helpers, they guarded the gates so no one could bring any goods to be sold in Yerushalayim on Shabbat. And then what happens? The store owners, they start complaining. So the merchants who used to sell the stuff on Shabbat start complaining, how can we closing the city? We want to keep our stores open on Shabbat. And so he warns them, he warns them and tells them, why are you staying outside the city? Why are you, trying to sell your things outside the city? Don't stay there. Don't do that again. Otherwise, I'm going to come and punish you. And from that time on, they didn't come back. So basically, Nehemiah takes a very strong stance. No stores open on Shabbat, even outside the walls of the city. And then he told the Levim, who were in charge of keeping these things, to make sure to sanctify the Sabbath day and to keep it properly and make sure the other people keep it properly. And then on top of that, this is a famous line, he also still, during that time, people were still intermarried. Yehudim, right, are taking Nashim Ashdodiyot, Ammoniot, and Moaviot. They're still intermarried. And a famous problem we have till this day, Uvnehem, Chatzim Medaber Ashdodit, Beinam Makirim Medaber Yehudit, Kelshon Ambam. Jewish children now, because of intermarriage, their kids aren't speaking, they're not speaking Hebrew even. Barivim Mamba Kalalem, he argues with them, he curses them, beats them up, okay, and makes them swear not to intermarry anymore and puts away, tries to put a stop to not just assimilation, but also intermarriage. So what do you see? We see financial corruption in the temple itself. We find Chilul Shabbat at the national level, and we find intermarriage, again, among the people. And even though we've returned and we built the walls up and everything, and we have a temple and everything, reality sets in, and you need leaders who know how to take action. Now, he does it in a very harsh way, Nehemiah, because he's powerful to do it. Does that mean nowadays we should use our political power to close shopping malls, or do we do it through conversation that you can argue? But I simply want to point out that even in a time of redemption, the fact that you see this as a time of redemption, redemption's begun, but you still have real day-to-day problems. People want to make a living, and it's difficult to keep Shabbat when you have to make a living, and people want to go shopping on Shabbat. To be able to enforce laws of keeping Shabbat again in the public sphere, that's important. And Nehemiah was able to deal with that. Intermarriage is a big fear all the time, and he was able to deal with that, as well as corruption in the temple, doing something about that, recognizing it, and doing something to fix it. So if we want to see the beginning of the Second Temple period as a time of redemption, the fact that Isaiah calls Koresh Mashiach, even though he's not even Jewish, and doesn't recognize God, and he's calling this as a time of redemption, and sees a great potential in it, even though it's a redemptive time period, we still have real problems of Chilul Shabbat and corruption and intermarriage and things like that. So we're not doing so great. We're not doing so bad either. So I thought that was just interesting to see how Nehemiah dealt with them. And again, I don't think we can learn from Nehemiah how to solve the problem, but we see from Nehemiah the need to solve the problem, to recognize problems and deal with it in the best way possible based on the situation you're in. Let me check the chat real fast. And I think our time's almost up. Yeah. Okay. Let's go backwards. Oh, Ein Chadash Tachat HaShemesh. Okay. That's true. That's next class in Kohelet, I guess. Okay. According to some historians, at least two people in Lloyd George's cabinet believe that they were doing the God's work. Okay, that's even better. Maybe they didn't see the hand of God. I would see the hand of God even if people in the cabinet didn't see it. But listen, people, because they're Christian, and they believe in the Bible and they believe in God, people like to see them in big historical events. So it's not surprising that people see the hand of God. It's interesting. I think sometimes non-Jews see the hand of God behind our return to Israel more than Jews do sometimes. Something to think about. Okay, because I froze for a while. I'm back. Everyone taking the call is rather familiar. Okay. And Irene wrote, Rav Cook happened to be in London in charge of, in 1970, telling our community to come back. Come out his talks with Balfour, 1 second. And listen, Rav Cook, and became chief rabbi. Okay. Yeah. And there's for sure, Rav Cook was the main one who saw the hand of God behind these events. That was for sure. Again, but many rabbis didn't see that. I was trying to understand why so many rabbis didn't see the hand of God. In hindsight, it's easy to see the hand of God. During that time period, because there were so many other reasons why the British were involved in the Middle East and they had other reasons to allow the Jews to return, they could have it wasn't necessarily, I could explain everything happening for political reasons. And it would make sense for people to say that can't be the hand of God. You know, redemption has to be miraculous and they're waiting for something bigger to happen. You can understand them as well. Okay. Okay. I mentioned something from before. Okay. Any other questions? Let me stop. Oh, one last thing I want to mention. Yeah, 1 second. I want to mention.
Judy wanted to know why we don't study these texts in our school system.
Oh, okay.
And I think that came up before you said you'd address it at the end.
Okay. So I'll relate to that. Why we don't, in my opinion, maybe because of a guilty conscience, but my whole point was that when you know this time period and study the texts, how you read Megillat Esther is a whole different ballgame, isn't it? That's what I tried to show you the last couple of weeks. And there was a saying way back that, on the flip side of it, in the religious Zionist movement, people were saying, we're reading too much Joshua, not enough Isaiah. It means we think that we're in a time, that when we returned in Bayit Sheni, we talked about this in the beginning, there was the first return during time of Yeshua when we had to conquer the land and kick out all the nations. And we turned in Second Temple period under a totally different political reality where we had to deal with reality and we weren't in a position to wipe out the nations and we weren't even commanded to. Nor do we have the ability to. And is our time period, do we compare it to Yeshua and we're commanded to wipe out the nations and take over everything? Can God be with us? Or do we have to be politically realistic and take whatever opportunity God gives us, but that does give us the right to kick other people out and things like that. That was an interesting, so a lot of people were saying, we're putting too much an emphasis on thinking that our return nowadays is like a time period of Yeshua, not like a time period of Ezra Nehemiah. And there's what to think about there as well. Again, the reason I said appreciate, I don't want to do what I used to do, what all my friends do, is say, oh, this proves to us we have to kick all the Arabs out and God begin it. It led to, way back in the 80s, it led to the people thinking, if God brought us back to our land and gave us a country and we have kibbutz galuyot and we follow Shmoneh Esrei, what do we say? We say in Tikkun Shabbos, we pray to God, v'abinu tzinecham, brinav, yushayim, big mitzvah, b'simchat olam, v'sham nasa lefanachet korban chovateinu. If God brought us back from Kibbutz Galiot, and the next step is building the Beit HaMikdash, so God throws us a pass, we have to run with it. So if we've returned to the land of Israel, the next step is to build the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore we have to blow up the mosque to, God's telling us we have to blow up the mosque and build the third temple. Now, I understand where people are coming from that, but that conclusion is extremely dangerous, and I think most people agree that's taking things a little bit too far. But there are some people who say, no, that's what God's telling us to do, and we're being punished for not doing that. I understand where they're coming from. I don't agree with that, but I'm trying to appreciate. And I think what we need to do, instead of learning these texts and saying, oh, I know that this direction is correct, it's important to be dedicated to what you believe in, but at the same time, realize the legitimacy of other opinions. So you can appreciate and thank God for what happened. That's what I want to end with my point I made before. To see the hand of God behind these events and thank him for it and say thank you and pray thank you and recognize there's an opportunity to take it to the next step. I think that's most important. What will be is more, it's not a question of predicting, oh, we know what's going to be and we have to play out that role, but rather we have to be worthy of the next stage of redemption. And what we need to do to make it worthy, that you have to study the entire Torah and see why we're chosen. And that's why the idea of making a name for God and being in a position to sanctify God in the eyes of the other nations enacting the way that sanctifies God, that'll be extremely important to help the process continue. What we need to do, you know, that's a different question. That goes back to political reality. Now, one thing I want to point out, like, she doesn't mind me say this, we mentioned briefly that one of the main things that Nehemiah did, and Ezra earlier, but also Nehemiah, was organizing the Levim and teaching Torah. They returned and built the wall, and we had, I guess, physical redemption. We were back on our land, but without educational redemption, without having the Levites teaching Torah and having ceremonies and having programs and teaching Torah, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere. And the beginning of return, the physical redemption is the first stage. The next stage is going to be more religious redemption, educational redemption. To become that people and make it things farther, you need Jewish education. And in ancient times, there were laws that required maser for, we talked about the Levim getting their maser, their 10%, which was an education tax, because you can't have civil servants teaching Torah if they're not paid. So in many ways, a 10% tax, nowadays, we need taxes to help poor people and other charity organizations, but helping educational institutions and educational programs, I think you can have, just like Ezra took upon himself, remember, they took a law and made a din d'rabbanan to add extra taxes, an extra third of a shekel and things like that, to make the redemption process faster. So I think anyone who wants to support Torah and Moshe might be a good example to help educational programs like Rabbi Jay is doing, and see that as maybe a type of fulfillment of a, not just of a biblical idea of giving maser, but also to helping the redemption process go farther, because to make it better, people have to be educated and Torah has to be kept properly. So first I want to thank Rabbi Kalman for organizing the program, but also people listening should, we can not just say thank you, but also act thank you. So the rest you can figure out.
Thank you very much. I really want to thank you for a wonderful, 21 weeks in a row. And
no practical conclusions. How's that?
No, that's the way it is. That's, we've been for 2,000 years, right? The question to think about the subject is much more important than reaching the conclusions. I want to thank you. We look forward to next week. This is just the end of the series with Rabbi Liebtag. Please God, we'll be back continuing. We're learning with him before this. So next 2 weeks will be on Pesach, but because we changed the clock this Saturday night, Sunday morning in Chutz Laretz. So next week's shiur will be at 11:15 Eastern time, but it'll be 6, until we make Aliyah, we still go by Eastern time, and it'll be at 5:15 Israeli time, and we look forward to seeing you. Of course, in about 7 minutes, Rabbanit Chana Henkin is going to be giving a talk on her late husband, the response of her husband, Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, an important major posek, so everybody's welcome to stay. We'll take a few minute break. And yes, I will say, after 21 weeks, all our classes are offered at no charge, but they're not free. These classes they do cost money to run, and in Kemachin Torah. So I'm just going to put the, I actually put our link to make a donation. And if those who have already, we thank you very much. And those who haven't, please consider, if you're capable, if you're able. And we want everybody to come for every reason, but if you can help to support, that would be greatly appreciated, now to expand and continue what we do. So thank you very much. We'll take a 6 minute break, and we'll continue at 12:30 with Rabbanit Henkin. So thank you very much. And thank you, Rabbi. And we look forward to Pesach next week from the Gula, beginning back to the first Gula, from the second Gula, now back to the first, the third, the second, the first Gula. And we'll see you soon. Thank you very much, everybody.
Menachem, can I ask you a question?
Yes,
sure. So now for the first time, I really see that at the end, when Nehemiah does all the things that he does, because of the corruption and because of the backsliding, it does seem a perfect parallel to today, where there was a, Reshit Smichat Gulatenu, and we came back. And then, so we have a government, we have a Medina, and they're not, they're not so Torah compliant as the people were in Nehemiah's day. So
yeah, we fulfilled Chanei Shimenu Kekedem.
Kekedem, right.
You have to hear what Kedem's referring to there.
So it's like we're waiting, it's still in the process. It's still ongoing. It's not over. And just as Nehemiah's story, you know, spooled out beyond the written story that we have in Sefer Nehemiah. So it's like we are living Sefer Nehemiah again in that time, but we don't know what the end of the story is because we don't know. It's all up to us. So I thank you.
It's up to us. That's it.
Yeah. And
realize it's up to us is one point. The other thing is now it's up to us. What do we need to prioritize? What do we need to do? It's not the same answer for everybody. Based on your abilities, understandings, some people should do this, some people should do that. I'm not doesn't mean everyone has to make aliyah and thing, because we're the globe strength. So you can live in Israel and not live in Israel nowadays. And you can live in Israel and not be here either. No, it's you can live in Teaneck and be more connected to Israel than people living in Tel Aviv sometimes.
Right. And one more thing, we have to thank Michlelet Herzog and Yeshivat Har Etzion for actually living out Nehemiah's dream of the Levium teaching Torah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Sure. And Torah in motion. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.